Radio Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, State Senator Peter Oberrocker is making a bid for Congress. The Republican lawmaker announced his campaign for New York's 19th district yesterday, and we were there. Some Wayne County constables are partnering with ICE, but what does that mean for local residents? With just a handful of foreign-born residents in the county, questions are mounting about the authority and oversight over other law enforcement. Liam Mayo of the River Reporter joins us live. The School Nutrition Action Coalition, supported by partners including Sullivan 180, Cornell Cooperative Extension, and local school districts, is strengthening ties between local farms and schools. Lights, Camera, Calicoon Art Walk in Calicoon isn't just about paintings and performances, it's bringing film to center stage, and Classical Kit with the latest Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra concert. After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi is testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Lawmakers are asking her about controversy and turmoil at the Justice Department. Bondi and her top aides have fired several career prosecutors who worked on the Capitol riot cases or investigated President Trump. Bondi defended her record since taking office.
We are returning to our core mission of fighting real crime. While there is more work to do, I believe in 8 short months, we have made tremendous progress towards those ends.
But Bondi is also accused of using her agency for political purposes. Her testimony comes less than 2 weeks after the Justice Department got an indictment against former FBI Director James Comey. President Trump has been demanding that Bondi take legal action against Comey. The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case about conversion therapy. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports the case could invalidate laws in half of U.S. states.
Conversion therapy, promoted by some conservative Christian groups, is banned for minors by half the states and staunchly opposed as harmful for minors by every major medical association. But today, lawyers for a Colorado therapist will tell the justices that because she uses only talk therapy, banning the practice violates the Constitution's free speech guarantee. Last term, the High Court upheld state laws that banned the use of hormones and other measures to help minors change their sex. Today, the shoe is on the other foot, so to speak, with a different group of states contending that they ban conversion therapy because it doesn't work and has proven harmful to minors. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
This is the seventh day of the federal government shutdown. It's affecting air traffic controllers who are not getting paid. There were no controllers at the Burbank Airport near Los Angeles last night, although the airport said it was still open. Staffing shortages were also reported in Denver and Newark Liberty Airport in New Jersey. Stocks opened mixed this morning as President Trump prepares to host his Canadian counterpart. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow dropped about 20 points in early trading.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney will visit Trump today at the White House for the second time, hoping to smooth some of the trade tensions that have been sparked by the president's tariffs. Canada is one of the United States' top trading partners. Trump announced the U.S. is buying a stake in Canada's Trilogy Metals mining company. It's one of the businesses that stands to benefit from the administration's opening of new copper mining territory in Alaska. Stock in Trilogy Metals more than tripled on the news. And two mid-sized banks are merging in a deal that would create the nation's ninth biggest bank. Fifth Third Bank Corp is buying Comerica for $10.9 billion. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 9 points. This is NPR. Today is the second anniversary of the Hamas-led attack on Israel. Nearly 1,200 people were killed by militants and 251 people were abducted. Following the attack, Israel began to attack Gaza. In the past 2 years, about 67,000 Palestinians have been killed in attacks by the Israeli military. New research from the artificial intelligence company Anthropic finds that college and university professors worldwide use AI to help them in the classroom. Lee Gaines reports.
Anthropic used an automated tool to analyze 74,000 conversations professors had with its AI chatbot, Claude. The findings show they used it for things like lesson planning and administrative tasks, and some of the conversations were about grading student work. Mark Watkins at the University of Mississippi studies the impact of AI on higher education.
And the sort of nightmare scenario that we might be running into is students using AI to write papers and teachers using AI to grade the same papers. If that's the case, then what's the purpose of education?
Anthropic also surveyed professors who said grading was the task that AI was least effective at. For NPR News, I'm Lee Gaines.
The governing body of men's professional tennis says it'll look at how significant heat affects players. Several competitors dropped out of a men's tennis tournament in Shanghai, China. The near 90-degree heat and 80% humidity have been overwhelming. Players have gotten sick on the court. Separately, women's star Emma Raducanu got sick at a tennis tournament in Wuhan, China, and she withdrew. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. State Senator Peter Oberacher is making a bid for Congress. The New York Republican lawmaker announced his campaign for New York's 19th congressional district yesterday. The seat is currently held by Democrat Josh Riley. Patricio Ravallo was there and has this report.
State Senator Peter Oberacher, who represents New York's 51st district, officially entered the race for New York's 19th congressional district, announcing his campaign at Holiday Mountain in Bridgeville. Surrounded by local Republican leaders, including newly elected Sullivan County GOP Chair Rob Doherty, Congressman Mark Lawler of the 17th District, and Assemblymember Chris Tague of the 102nd. Oberacher called the 19th one of the most important districts in the state. The seat is currently held by Democrat Josh Riley, who narrowly defeated Republican Mark Morellano in 2024.
So this November, we must reject the socialist agenda of Hochul and Riley and Mondavi and ensure our values are represented and heard in Washington. And I'll tell you this, the greatest title I'll ever hold isn't senator, and it ain't congressman. It's pop-pop. And that's why I'm running. Because I want my grandkids and yours to have the same opportunities that I had, to grow up in safe communities, to live in the country that protects our freedoms, and to stay here in upstate New York, to build their lives, instead of feeling forced like they have to leave. To have the opportunity to live and achieve the true American dream. That's the fight, that's the mission, and that's why I'm asking for your support, for your faith, and for your vote. Because soil is our common ground, and together, rooted in that same soil, we can build a stronger New York and a stronger America.
Earlier in the day, Congressman Josh Riley's campaign manager issued a statement and responded to Oberacher's announcement. That campaign criticized Oberacher as an Albany insider with close ties to corporate interests and said they'd be ready to compare his record with Riley's if he wins the Republican nomination. When asked about the statement, Oberacher replied,
Well, number one, Joshua, I mean, you know, well, I haven't seen him around, so I'm not really too worried about that. They can say whatever they want. In reality, I think my record stands for itself, you know, in here. Work the district, people know me, and I think people will vote for me in that capacity. So I'm not worried about what anybody says.
In Bridgeville, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
Now, local constables in Damascus and Preston Townships in Wayne County have joined a federal partnership program with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, raising questions about the scope of their authority and the county's role in federal immigration enforcement. Joining us live is Liam Mayo of The River Reporter with the details. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So can you explain these ICE partnership programs and how local constables in Wayne County are involved?
Yeah. So ICE has these arrangements known as Section 287G partnerships, or the 287G program. And that program, just according to sort of the direct words from one of the flyers they've put out, it enhances the safety and security of our nation's communities by allowing ICE enforcement and removal operations to partner with state and local law enforcement agencies to identify and remove criminal aliens who are amenable to removal from the U.S. So ICE has these partnerships with law enforcement sort of at all levels across the United States. And in our area, the only partnerships that sort of it has under this model, at least according to the information on its website, are these two with the constables in Damascus Township and Preston Township. The Damascus Township constable joined in April 29. The Preston Township constable joined May 8. So these were both back in the spring that they joined.
So why would ICE want to partner with local law enforcement here when it seems there's a very small foreign-born, if you will, population in the county?
Yeah. In reporting on this, we asked the Damascus constable if Wayne County was considered a hotspot for ICE. Only 3.7% of residents in Wayne County are foreign-born as per the 2020 census. And if you do a little math, that rounds out to approximately 52 foreign-born residents in all of Wayne County. There were two ICE raids back in the spring on the same business, Elegante's in Honesdale. If I'm getting my dates right, I believe one of them happened prior to these constables joining this partnership, March 29. The other happened at the end of May after those agreements. We asked the Damascus Township Constable why he would participate in this program, and he said that it's something that several constables across the state are doing, and he said, quote, "I think it's a good thing that anyone who's questioning it knows that their local law enforcement is keeping an eye on it." So at least from that, it's less sort of it's less to participate with ICE necessarily and more to have an ear in what ICE may be doing locally.
And just to be clear, foreign born refers to a person not a U.S. citizen at birth, including naturalized citizens, lawful permanent residents, and temporary visitors. That's defined by the U.S. Census Bureau. So those, you know, approximately 52 people, we don't know their immigration status. Have there been any reported arrests or actions by constables under this program so far? And what's behind the tension of constables in Pennsylvania, you know, some of the other conflicts they've faced with law enforcement historically?
Yeah, we don't have any reports on constables locally taking any action with ICE through this program. We just have the sort of documents that they signed saying that they are signing up to be part of this program. There is kind of a broader statewide thing where specifically the constables in our area are advocating for an expansive understanding of the role of constables. Constables in Pennsylvania are a little different than they are in New York, where they are an elected office at the township level. The Damascus Township Constable specifically sort of works, you put together a constable law handbook and assists in running stateconstable.us, which looks to share information about the rights and roles of constables. And there are other websites that sort of have had this, or that do this kind of advocacy for the role of constables. There's another one, the Pennsylvania Police Alliance, that does include sort of this, in addition to information about the role of constables, it includes information on sort of how, or links to how constables can sign up for this 287G program. So it's something that kind of a little bit goes hand in hand with this more expansive role.
And again, the constables are not police officers, although they do have some enforcement depending on their local district or their area that gives them that authority. Have you know residents said anything, or and what does it mean for local residents and the relationship between constables and the community?
We haven't necessarily heard anything from local residents, and again, we do not have any information at this time of constables actively participating or partnering with ICE.
All right, let's talk about another story in the River Reporter. A solar project that's been proposed in Damascus, a proposed 2.25 megawatt project. Can you give us a little bit more information about that and some of the environmental and community concerns that have been raised?
Yeah, so this is Damascus Township, same areas we've been talking about so far. And what is kind of interesting about this project is it's the third solar project currently in development in Damascus. This most recent one is sort of a smaller one, a 2.25 megawatt facility proposed off Route 371. And this one is just sort of still in the initial permitting stages. The other two, the names have kind of changed a couple times throughout development, but what's been known as Tylerville Solar 1 is about twice the size. And then there's one called Coast Energy, which is both in Damascus Township and Lebanon Township, the neighboring township. Those are both kind of working through their permitting process, but sort of currently eyeing 2026. So they're conditional, their permitting has been extended, one of them into April 2026, the other into September 2026. And the first is, or one of them, the Tylerville Solar Project, is sort of still trying to get approval from the Wayne County Conservation District and other like local entities. The other, Coast Energy project, that one sort of has more of its stuff together, but it needs work to be done with the local energy utility so that it can connect the solar that it's doing to the grid, and that's not going to happen until 2026. So it's that's sort of why it is pushing its timeline a little further out.
So there are a few more steps to go before there's a public hearing that comes up.
Yeah, for that first one, and there have been other public hearings that we've sort of followed throughout the past couple of months and years on both of these projects. But it interests me a little bit because of the just what I might say about the trends in energy development across Pennsylvania, that there are like currently three solar project, utility scale solar projects being developed in one township in rural Wayne County.
Right.
There was a notice from the Pennsylvania Utility Commission earlier this year talking about the 2 gigawatt milestone being reached, where they are generating 2 gigawatts, or there is 2 gigawatts of solar generation available across Pennsylvania. And what they said was that they hit the 2 gigawatt mark in July of 2025, and they had hit the 1 gigawatt milestone in 2023. So they double, or Pennsylvania has doubled its solar energy generation capacity in just about 17 months. Mm-hmm. So the press release said that there's been a steep increase in both the number and capacity of solar installations in Pennsylvania over the past 2 years, fueled by improving economics, developer interest, and strong policy foundations. And a lot of the talk, I think, recently has turned to fracking in Pennsylvania, and with that being looked at as a tool to, you know, like something that can be boosted to help fuel AI data centers and all of the like power needs that the area is going to have in the future. But Pennsylvania is also sort of committed to this multi-tier approach, like the all of the above approach, where it's looking at sort of all of the different forms of energy it can use. And solar energy appears to be one that is still kind of taking off.
Rapidly adapting to that. The River Reporter's Liam Mayo, you can read his reporting and all the team's reporting at riverreporter.com. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, farm to school, Sullivan County's coalition bringing local food and fresh lessons to cafeterias. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Another way to help us bring you the news is donate a vehicle you don't need. Car, truck, motorcycle, you can donate to this station and it could mean hundreds of dollars of support. Thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not. Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. What started as a federal grant has blossomed into a countywide movement connecting Sullivan County farms with school cafeterias and reshaping how students experience lunch. The School Nutrition Action Coalition, formed when Sullivan 180 received a USDA grant last year, aimed at strengthening ties between local farms and schools. I spoke with Dara Williams, Food Service Director at Sullivan West Central School District, Joy Leon, Nutrition and Physical Activity Educator with Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County, and Denise Frangipani, Executive Director of Sullivan 180, about the program.
The School Nutrition Action Coalition really came together when Sullivan 180 was fortunate to receive a grant from USDA. So that was what brought everyone to the table, was the USDA grant, because it was part of the goal and the mission of that grant that we build a collaboration. In our mind, it was a countywide collaboration around how to get a better connection between our local regional farms and our school cafeterias. And so we took the lead to facilitate the conversation and keep the meetings happening regularly. But the coalition really is a network of community partners with all of our school districts and our food service directors and staff.
And the goal has been to provide free, healthy, locally sourced meals daily, two of them, in fact. How is that going and how do you support schools in achieving that goal?
So the free part is really out of our control because it's really driven by USDA and the state. And I believe at this point, all of our schools receive free and reduced lunch.
New York State passed it in their budget resolution last year to have universal free meals for all students in New York State.
So when we started, that wasn't the case, but it was always the vision that students should be able to eat their lunch for free. And our goal is to really enhance that lunch experience, both from a what are we putting on our plates point of view to the whole experience of eating lunch. So I like to tell the story. If you go to a restaurant, right, and the food is good, you'll go back. If the vibe is good and the atmosphere is good, you'll go back. You'll bring your friends. Like it's a fun, happy place to be. So that's the vision of this coalition, is that the lunchroom should be the same for the students, as well as really a classroom where our students can learn about where their food comes from, why certain foods, you know, what's the benefit of certain foods and why they're healthy for you, and just change the whole outlook on food. Because for some of our students, this is our best shot at getting them those healthy meals. Well, for some of them, unfortunately, because of where we live and some of the challenges of our community, this may be the only meals that they get in a day, right? So it's, you know, that's the sad, hard truth of what we're facing as a community overall, as a nation, really. But locally, we look at that and we say, we have the ability through this coalition and these incredible partners to change that for our students.
And you have two food lunchroom experts that we've brought along here. Dara, I want to talk to you about how it's working for you as the food service director at Sullivan West and implementing this. And how does it change your daily operations in terms of like logistics of what you do, but then also menu planning and then the student experience?
Okay. So yes, and this has been something that I've been dreaming of for many years since I became a school lunch manager. And the idea that, you know, local farms could supply products that we could serve, prepare and serve in our school meal programs. So I'm really happy to say we've come a long way, baby. And things are looking good. Logistically speaking, of course, when you are bringing in raw, locally grown vegetables, fruits, even some dairy products and or meat products, it takes a while and takes skill to break that down. So there's additional staff requirement, whereas in the past, during what we call the chicken nugget generation age, where they opened boxes and heated up food and served it from there, we have a lot more work to do every day. washing, peeling, slicing, dicing, prepping food, cooking it from scratch. There's education involved. So we have to go over our recipes, talk about it, discuss them. How are we going to execute the recipes? And so it takes a lot. It takes a whole team that's coordinated every day to make it happen.
You had said that you had dreamed, the day you dreamed of, is something that it doesn't sound like that's a much of a burden for you, because it is something that you're providing fresh nutritional food for folks.
Yes. No, I love it. Yeah. I actually love to see it. I love to do it. I love to be part of it. It's really exciting. It's also great to talk to farmers and, you know, give them the opportunity to provide the products to our schools directly. There are a lot of farms in the Sullivan West community that we procure goods from, you know, meats and vegetables, poultry. And it's great talking to them. We've developed a nice relationship. We have are on a one-name basis. I call Tony Campanelli. Hey, Tony, how you doing? Can I get some chicken? He's like, yeah, no problem, Dara, whatever you need. So it's really nice to have that relationship with the farmers.
Well, given that there are so many farms in the community and your personal relationship with the farmers, why did it take so long to come to light?
Well, the school nutrition program is funded primarily by the USDA through reimbursements for meals served. We don't get a lot of money. So a lot of times the roadblock is money. Like, can we afford it? And we have to be very creative, and we have to be very frugal. And there's also procurement rules and regulations that we have to follow. There's bidding involved for all the products that we buy. There's been some changes in the rules recently where we can use a local as a requirement on the bid. So, you know, we can – that eases the burden of the documentation to do the bidding process. But it's still about dollars and cents. And, you know, if we're getting – I think, what is it, $4.75 a lunch reimbursed. That's not a lot of money. That has to cover all our supplies, all our labor. It's a tough road to hoe.
Well, I was of the rectangular frozen pizza generation, so I'm happy to hear that there's some healthier options. What have the students been saying to you, and what has the feedback been from their families, too?
Oh, well, we get a lot of positive feedback. From, you know, the little kids, you know, they're still trying to understand what's going on with the lunch light to begin with, and all the options that are there in front of them. It's kind of overwhelming, but they're getting used to it. But high school students generally will tell us right off the bat what they think of an idea. Today we ran a new menu option called Turkey Carnita Rice Bowl. And it was made with.
I want that.
Yeah, it was really good. It was really good. So, we almost ran out of food. I mean, we were very close. I think we had one pan left of the food. So it was a great recipe that first go out. So, you know, next week we're doing a chicken vegetable lo mein bowl. So
yeah, if you see me sneaking into line, you'll know why. Joy, tell me a little bit more about how Cornell Cooperative Extension partners with schools and other partners to amplify the impact of all these programs.
Cornell Cooperative Extension of Sullivan County is involved in so many different things, from family services to nutrition, agriculture. So we're connected to the farmers through various programs, such as the Beginner Farmer Program. And we're also connected to all the districts. If you've ever heard of 4-H, that's also happening at Cornell Cooperative Extension. So when Sullivan 180 received the Farm to School grant, it's not the first farm to school grant that we've had in this county, but it's the first in a while. And so what they wanted to do, and we wanted to do together, is to connect the cafeteria, the classroom, and the community. So when you think about it, that really involves almost everybody, all of the residents here in Sullivan County.
Do you think that this is maybe one of the more impactful programs because of all the people that are involved and how it just brings everybody to the table?
I hope so. What I do know is that as a student here, when I was growing up, I took the school lunch completely for granted. You know, it didn't cross my mind that school lunch was a complicated process. And getting involved in the work here with Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan 180, and the school districts, I can really understand so many different things about what goes into getting the food on the trays. And it's really a miracle. The cafeterias are working with such constrained budgets to feed so many people every day.
What are some of the successes you've seen from your perspective in improving nutrition, student behavior, community engagement?
Well, I love working with the students directly and talking to them about nutrition and food. And I know that some of our partners have worked hard to create taste tests, and the students get the opportunity to say whether they like the food, yes, please, serve this more, or no, thank you. And so the students will put stickers on a poster, and it creates an awesome visual reference for what the students like and what they want more of and what they would rather not have.
Can you tell us what they're kind of liking these days and what they're maybe not liking so much?
Well, we had a single bite come in to do a taste test at Sullivan West High School. The principal helped serve the samples, and it was a big hit. So, I mean, I think given the opportunity, kids will try new things. So it's definitely a good thing
to be exposed to them and be shown these things.
Yeah, so generally speaking, I always advise the food service workers to put out samples. They have to put out a sample tray to show what the meal looks like. And then if a student is not sure, we encourage them to take a taste test. You know, give it a try. If you like it, then have it for lunch. If you don't, then it's okay. We have other options.
Looking ahead, and maybe this is for each of you, Joy, we'll start with you. What are your goals or your thoughts about expanding access to these meals and student nutrition education in the county?
Well, I'm pretty excited because Cornell Cooperative Extension received a grant this year, and we are doing a number of events, including the Big Apple Crunch, which has momentum in each of the school districts on its own, but that's something that we're involved in getting the food service directors local apples so that each student can take a bite of an apple at pretty much the same time, or at least the same week this October. And we also have taste tests on the menu. So to speak, we have classroom education sessions planned or in the works, and lots of other fun events like gardening activities. So it really does take a community, and we have lots of things on the horizon.
Dara, what are you looking forward to?
Well, we will be having a farm-to-school fair, basically, on October 16th at Sullivan West Elementary School. We invite local farmers, vendors, support team people like our friends at Sullivan 180 and Cornell Cooperative Extension to interact with the students and teach them about local food. And taste test samples, and we're also having Barbara Moran with her farm animals for a little bit of a petting zoo type of setup. It's a great event. This is our fifth year, I believe, doing the event, and it's very well received. Students love it.
I'm telling you, I'm coming over. Like, now there are animals to pet. Denise, tell us what your goals are as we wrap up here.
One of the things we have accomplished so far, and we will do again, this was our second food service staff conference we did this past August, and we'll be doing that again next year. So we're already planning that, because to bring all of our food service staff from throughout the county, all of our districts together for one day or 2 days of not only skills and staff development, but just enrichment for themselves and connecting and having a day where they can just enjoy, because they really are I'm not only saying this because Dara is here, but they are really, we hear stories about, you know, when I was growing up, it was the lunch ladies. Dawn would say lunch ladies and meal men if she were here. But the people in the cafeteria who see our children every day are feeding our children. Food is so much better when it is shared. And so the whole lunch experience is not just about, okay, it's lunchtime, go eat. And it can really change the trajectory of a student's day. So I'm looking forward to keeping these conversations going and really holding Sullivan County up as a model for other communities of how you can work on a county level. If we can accomplish it in Sullivan County, I think you can accomplish it pretty much anywhere. And it's been great so far.
Really. And, you know, not just during the day, they might take some of those healthy habits home with them or ask to find some of those healthier foods.
That is one of the goals. Yeah. Yes, that's what we're trying to do. So it's the more we can talk about it and the more we can, you know, celebrate it, and maybe you'll bite an apple one day this week on the air. Who knows? It's all of us, as Joyce said, it really does maybe Jarrah said it, we all may have said it, it really does take a community. And when it comes to our children and food and working with our farmers, they're excited. They want to keep their food in Sullivan County to the extent possible. It's economics as well. So when we speak with a farmer, we're saying, we don't want you to give it away. That wouldn't make any economic sense. We want to be able to get it at a price point that is manageable for our schools, but we also want the farmer to benefit. It's a business.
And then also just seeing that in the kids in the community, that food going right to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Denise Frangipani of Sullivan 180, Darrah Williams, Food Service Director at Sullivan West, and Joy Leon, Nutritional and Physical Activity Educator, Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County. Thank you all.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Calicoon Art Walk with the focus on the big screen at the Calicoon Theater. We'll get a preview next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Coming up on WCNY's The Capitol Press Room, we'll check in with State Senator Andrew Gunardis about rules and regulations designed to protect kids when they use social media. And we'll also get to know one of the aspiring Democratic candidates to be the next state comptroller here in New York. All that and much more, wherever you download, stream, or tune in, WCNY's The Capitol Press Room. This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Calicoon Art Walk returns this weekend, and while the streets and storefronts will be alive with paintings and music and performances, the spotlight also shines on the big screen. This year's event features a series of film screenings at the Calicoon Theater, and they're showcasing the creativity and storytelling talent emerging from the region's art scene. I spoke with Marcus Brooks, Ali Azios, and Elizabeth Ennis about the film screenings at Art Walk and the Twisted Tuesdays event kickoff tonight.
So it's every Tuesday in October. The first one is the Rocky Horror Picture Show, October 7th. October 14th, They Live. October 21st, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And October 28th, Spooky Cartoons and Nosferatu, scored by Radiohead.
Wow. These are some classic, going back to late 70s, early 80s, even back to 1922.
Right.
All right. Let's talk also about some of the things that are happening at Art Walk. How did this whole idea about having fantastical films come up to be a part of Art Walk?
I started this, I think, at least 6-7 years ago. And I've been doing it every year with Chrissy Smith at the Calicoon Theater, who is totally super supportive. I have a very big community of local filmmakers and international filmmakers. And so I try to keep it all short and really represents how insanely creative it is up here.
So these are short films,
right?
On Saturday, the 11th, during Art Walk. Are these newer films? Are they films that have existed before, haven't been seen before?
A mix of both. Quite a few have never been seen before. And one is an animation from the 80s by Lisa Crafts that is incredible hand-drawn animation. So that's the oldest one. Everything else is pretty new.
How are folks, responding to being part of Art Walk?
Well, I got an incredible response in a call for submissions. Actually, too many films to include. I try to keep it under an hour so nobody goes crazy. And the people are very excited to be in this. And we'll probably, at the 12 p.m. showing, have some feedback from the filmmakers and the audience.
You've got a nice roster of folks. Anything in particular you want to shout out here, including one from someone who might be sitting next to you?
Right. Exactly. Allie and Marcus are both going to have a film. And I want to do a shout out to Michelle Negroponte of Livingston Manor, who does incredible films. They're very odd mix of documentary yet not. They're very beautiful. He's an incredible cinematographer. And he also works with Allie and Marcus, documenting all the things at New Memories. And I'm a big fan, and he's been in every program for the past 6-7 years.
And Allie and Marcus, can you shed a little light on your short film that will be screened at during Art Walk?
Yeah, it's a really funny one, in my opinion. It's a short film of our son telling a joke, except for his joke is completely intelligible. And so it's like, but it's hilarious.
And he's on his path to fame. Also at the Calicoon Theater during Art Walk, you've got the Too Short to Suck Film Festival. So it's a day full of film during Art Walk. This starts at 5. Tell us a little bit more about this and how it came to be part of Art Walk this year. Because the festival happened already. We've talked about that before. But how did this come to be?
Well, Nicole at the Depot, the Calicoon Depot, she was a sponsor for, we got a DVA grant, and she was a sponsor for it. And so when Art Walk came around this year, she invited us to show the films at Art Walk, which we were very excited to do.
The Too Short to Suck Film Festival is an annual film festival that we've been putting together at the New Memory Space. And essentially every submission has to be under 2 minutes, and that's the only rule. So we had about 30 or 40 submissions, and in the actual length of the complete program is about an hour and 10 minutes, hour and 20 minutes, something like that. But it's a really great diversity of filmmakers, young and old, all, you know, mostly from the community. And it's just a really exciting way to get out and see some interesting short films.
And I'm included.
Yes.
And so is this what folks would have seen at the festival, or did you condense it a little bit for this presentation?
Yeah, it's the exact program as far as all of the films that are included. The only thing that you kind of miss is the award ceremony that we do over at the Memories Complex whenever that happens. So you unfortunately won't be able to get to see the shining lights of the awards ceremony, but you will see all of the actual
It was the whammies, right?
Yeah. Talk a little bit about, and Elizabeth, you alluded to this too, but like just a little bit more about how deep the bench is when it comes to filmmaking in our area, especially this genre of like maybe more experimental filmmaking, more creative filmmaking.
It's pretty amazing. My colleague, Michelle Negroponte, turned me on to a bunch of people also. But I have some cred after doing this for so long. So people came out of the woodwork to submit. So there's a lot.
And you guys have been doing the Too Short to Suck Film Festival for a couple of years now. What have you been seeing in terms of the evolution of the type of filmmaking in our area?
It's amazing, actually. There are a lot of, you know, what's great about Too Short to Suck is that anyone can submit a film, and it can be shot on your phone. It could be, you know, about anything as long as it's 2 minutes or under. And so we also got an incredible amount of submissions this past year and the year before. And, you know, some children made films that were incredible. So we find that the filmmaking sort of industry out here in terms of just normal people making films is pretty awesome. So
more things going on at New Memories, the home of the Too Short to Suck Film Festival, including something this weekend that's helping us out a little bit. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about WJFF Fest that you guys have helped put together?
Yes, we're really excited about this. On Sunday, October 12th, from 5 to 9, we're going to have a bunch of bands play, and we're doing a fundraiser for WJFF, and all proceeds go to the station. We're going to have Creatures are going to play, Basic Bitches, CRISPR, Edison Rocket Train, and we also have OFS playing. So it's going to be really, really, really fun.
All great live music. What a great lineup. Thanks for putting that together. Thanks for helping us out, too. We appreciate that. And I just think it'll be a great, fun evening. And you guys don't sleep. Tell us a little bit more about the Decrepit Ghouls coming up in A Cursed Catskills Cruise.
We're really excited to bring back the Decrepit Ghouls with PAC and DVAA's giving us a donation as well for it, and also the Flying Saucer Entertainment Group that actually writes the program for the Decrepit Ghouls. But it's going to be a really great event. It's our third year doing it. There's going to be an ensemble of cast of characters that are going to come back to haunt you and to entertain you. So it'll be Friday and Saturday, which would be October 24th and 25th. We have it at 6 p.m. is going to be a boat and lounge act. And 7 p.m. we'll have the show will begin. So we'll do that on Friday and Saturday. And then we'll have kind of more of a child-friendly event on Sunday, the 26th, that will start at 3 p.m. and the show will start at 4 p.m. So, you know, dress your best in your Halloween apparel and get ready to be scared and entertained.
Igor really freaked me out.
Yeah, and it's great. It's great this year. The theme is a cursed Catskills crew. So it will be a nautical theme. The ghouls actually take over a cruise ship and they entertain the cruise guests. And there is a kind of a boating narrative that happens. So make sure to bring your floats.
Thank you guys so much. That's Ali Azos, Marcus Brooks, and Elizabeth Ennis. Twisted Tuesday starts tonight at the Calicoon Theater. And then on the weekend, it is the Fantastical Films at the Calicoon Theater at 11 and at noon. And then later that day, the 2025 Too Short to Suck Film Festival. That's during Calicoon Art Walk. You can find out more at thecalicoontheater.com or at visitcalicoon.com about all the Art Walk events. And then there's WJFF Fest, which is coming up Sunday this weekend at New Memories. More information on our website. And Decrepit Ghouls. There's more information at decrepitghouls.com, of course. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you,
Tim. Thanks for having us.
We should note the Calicoon Business Association is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the latest Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra Classical Kit has the details next.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected this election season. October 25th is the last day to register to vote in New York State. Early voting begins October 25th and ends November 2nd. Find your early voting polling place at elections.ny.gov. Election Day is November 4th. New York polls are open on Election Day from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. This is Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra's next concert is called Light and Dark. Our own Classical Kit caught up with Andrew Trombley from the Chamber Orchestra about how this program shines a light on both the classic and the contemporary in chamber music.
Good morning, and thanks for taking time from your really busy schedule this year to speak to me about Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra's October concerts, the beginning of your fall season.
Yes, and oh, thank you, Kat. We always appreciate taking the time to chat with you, and you know, we thank you for sharing our programs with all of your listeners.
Well, it's a pleasure to do that, and you're going to be having two concerts coming up this coming weekend. Saturday evening at St. John's Episcopal Church in Monticello and Sunday afternoon at the Reformed Presbyterian Church in White Lake. And this is going to be a program of string quartets. And yeah. I understand you're going to start with the father of the string quartet, Haydn. You're going to be including a string quartet by Florence Price, which for our listeners who might not be familiar with her, she was an extraordinary composer, but, you know, she was an African-American woman at a time when women weren't getting much orchestral exposure, though she did have one of her symphonies performed by the Chicago Symphony. But in 2019, a whole wealth of her music was found in the attic of a building in Illinois, and
say rescued. It was a dilapidated building, and you know, I think we were probably moments away from her entire catalog being lost forever.
Wow. Yeah, and ever since, we've been bit by bit, more and more of her music is being performed and recorded, so I'm thrilled that you're going to be doing her string quartet. And then you're going to be closing the concert with Beethoven's string quartet in F minor, which is known as Serioso because it was written during a very serious and stressful time of his life. And I believe that he even said that it was so different from what he'd done before that he didn't want it to be ever performed except for a circle of friends. And so I'm glad that his wish didn't come true. So Could you tell us
The man has moved on from this world, so I think we're entitled to do what we wish with his music at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. So could you tell us how you went about putting together this program?
Of course. So this was also a brainchild of the string quartet performing. Last year, we had the same exact string quartet of Akiko, Naho Perini, Chuchen Liu, and Alberto Perini. They all performed together, and they really enjoyed their time together. I mean, all of our musicians really enjoy making music with each other, but this particular group, they wanted to come back and do it again. And this ended up becoming, in discussions with me, trying to figure out what would have worked best, this ended up becoming a really interesting study into these three composers at three very different parts of their life. As you know, at this point, when Haydn wrote the Joe Quartet, he was in the employment of the Esterházy family, and this was almost at the peak of his composition career, not quite at a level of European fame, but certainly he was extremely successful with his employment. So there's a lot of creative freedom just to be able to experiment and have fun and find joy in the string quartet form that he really cultivated and refined and mastered for the rest of the world. This was at a time when he decided to switch up the format of the string quartet a little bit by not putting so much emphasis and focus on a single player with the rest of the instruments providing counterpoint, harmony, and color. This is at a time where he decided to have all of these voices equally have more level of contribution to create a more of a democratic string quartet. And then, of course, being the Joe Quartet, he throws in all of his wit and his humor, and you'll get to really experience that at the very end of the last movement. So it's a great, really, really fun way to start off the concert. And Florence Price, this was when she found a new level of inspiration. Being born in Little Rock, Arkansas, spending much of her time there, education, early writing. Eventually, just with the Jim Crow era, she did not find a level of comfort and inspiration being in Arkansas, so she moved to Chicago, and she became heavily involved in the Chicago art scene and contributing to a Chicago musical renaissance. So this quartet was composed around that time, that transition where she brought herself and her two daughters to a new city. This is just before the Symphony No. 1 was premiered by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. So what you hear in this Florence Price is a lot of inspiration, where she feels comfortable combining elements of what European Western classical music with Negro folk spirituals to create and start to find her own truly unique voice. So, you know, we have Haydn, a level of comfort and mastery with Florence Price, a level of inspiration. And then with Beethoven, this is at a very dark point of his life. And this is one of the few times where the composer would actually give the nickname to the quartet itself. Usually these names come much later, maybe after the premiere or after the composer has even passed in a lot of ways. And this was at a time when Vienna was occupied by France. A lot of his connections, a lot of his colleagues have left Vienna. A lot of his benefactors have left Vienna because of the occupation. So Beethoven was feeling financially isolated, creatively isolated, and his hearing loss really started to become much more prominent. And he said that he always felt like he was living in between halfway in the world of the deaf and in the world of those who were able to hear. So it's interesting that, you know, all these three composers, probably relatively similar in age at that time, going through three extremely different points of their life, creating three very different types of string quartets, but all equally profound and powerful.
The Haydn, even though it's got that humor, it's got the syncopation in that second movement, and of course this ending, which I won't give away. Just I will say, you know, don't be too quick to be the first person to applaud. That's all I'll say about it. But with Florence Price, I mean, One thing that's interesting to me is there are only two movements, correct? But the second movement almost is like two movements because it's got this, you know, very sweet and romantic melody, and then it breaks into a very playful dance kind of rhythm, and then back to the other. I know some people call it unfinished, but do we really know that she didn't intend to write a third movement? Because it seems quite complete to me as it is.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that's probably one of those things that, you know, can we always add more? When I work with composers living now, several times, you'll see several revisions and changes. And you're always wondering, what else can you do? You know, I mean, I think it's similar to when we're all cooking a nice meal at home and I'll have my wife come over and take something. It's like, hey, what else do we need? What else do we need? There must be something that we're missing. And at some point, it might just be enough, and maybe it's not. But I think in this case, you know, who knows whether she could have and would have added more. She had a lot to say. She grew up with so many songs being sung to her that, you know, it just became interwoven with all of her compositions, all of her symphonic music, and certainly being using these songs as teaching tools as well. You know, we have a beautiful arrangement that Akiko did of the Adoration for organ, which she was a wonderful organist at that time. So, you know, could there have been more? Probably, but is it enough to create a very compelling piece of music? Absolutely. You know, it's a journey, and I think that's the important thing to take away from it.
Moving on to the Beethoven, you know, I mean, that was such a terrible time in his life, and I believe that along with suffering from the hearing loss, I mean, he was kind of surrounded by the sounds of cannons going off, and I mean, the city was actually being invaded. And I think also he was in love with one of his students. You know, she wouldn't marry him because his social status was too low for her. And she would have lost custody of her children if she'd married him. You know, so it's just like heartbreak on so many levels. But out of it comes just this music that sounds very modern to me. You know, even though it was written two centuries ago. These are all composers who were trying new things and just blossoming in different kinds of ways, whether it was from something positive or something negative or just whatever. And I think you're putting them together in a program is going to be a wonderful experience for your audience.
Oh, thank you. We're looking forward to performing it, and, you know, we're looking forward to have everyone there. It's going to be a real special look inside the human psyche and how our circumstances, they never cripple us. All our lives and what happens around us, all it can do is mold us and shape us, and great things can come out of that, whether it's moments of profound beauty and happiness or at our lowest points in our lives.
Well, and I like that the title for this particular program is Light and Dark. You know, these are dark times. Can't really exaggerate that any more than it is. But the fact that in our own community, you are bringing this incredible talent and beauty of centuries of music that does bring us some light and lets us know that no matter what is going on in the world, the arts are things that bring us together, you know, that speak to everyone, no matter what other things people don't agree about. And I really just appreciate so much that Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra does this and brings us this. And I thank you for that.
Well, that means a lot to us. You know, music, if it does anything, it provides a moment in time where we can all experience the same thing together, where we have different experiences that really divide us across our lives.
So the first concert will be this Saturday, October 11th at 7 p.m. at St. John's Episcopal Church in Monticello. And then the next day there will be a matinee, October 12th at 3 at the Reformed Presbyterian Church. That's on 17B in White Lake. If you go to Nesson Cultural Arts, I believe you'll find a link to that, and also on your Facebook page. And yeah, is that Facebook page?
Is always the best place to find our information.
Andrew, thank you so much for coming back again, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kit. We always appreciate talking to you.
And that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, new show, Capital Press Room at 1, followed by Freakonomics Radio at 2. Up next, it's On Point. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.